Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Yada Yada Radio. My pleasure to be with you. We have a full cast of characters tonight. We have Kirk from California. Okay, Kirk. We have James from the Republic of Texas. And Larry down there from Florida. Hi, guys.
We have our own little subculture down here.
Yeah, we do.
Glad to be
on. Okay, we're covering the nation pretty good.
Yeah, I think we are. And I'm today in Virginia. A couple things just as notes. We did begin observations, which is the replacement program, really, for Shattering Myths. Scott is the one recording it, and he is also producing it and responsible for not only participating, but also for getting it out. As I understand it, he has gotten it out to BB, Steve, and as you have posted it on YouTube, and he's gotten it out to Richard, and Richard has posted it on his West Yawa site. It is designed to be a blend of what we do here and what we did with Shattering Myths. We are still going to talk about some news, but only news in the sense that it resonates with the story Yahweh is trying to tell us. So news that speaks of the problems associated with religion, politics, militarism, and that sort of thing. And so we did our first. We besmirched Christmas and Christianity, as we ought to do, and also spoke of the first Sharia-compliant airline and how much fun it would be to fly the deadly skies. And at that point, we went into a universal discussion on the covenant, which we will conclude in our second edition of the observations. But it's observations, history, past, present, and future, observations of Yahweh's Torah and its application to our lives. And that being the case, there's no reason to speak of the stupidness of Christianity and everything associated with Christianity tonight, because there is no one listening to this program tonight that is celebrating Christmas or that views it with anything other than utter disdain. A couple of other things I'd like to share. One is that for those who have sent me emails, I am about a month to a month and a half behind. I promise I am going to catch up on them. If you give me another couple of weeks, I'm going to be diligent about catching up on emails, though I have let them slip. And second, the goal here in about a week or so is to get busy translating again and writing. We named this program that we're doing now, and we'll post about 2 hours of program each week. Observations, that's the name of the new book that I'm trying to compile, and it's really all based on observations from the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. So that's pretty much the announcements, at least from my perspective. You guys have anything you'd like to add?
We got a question here in, sure. UT, which is from Russ Baskin. He's asking, how old was Noah when he passed? Because he never died.
I think it does say, and I know it's in the text that we have here, but I quite honestly don't know the answer to that. But many, many, many hundreds of years. I don't think it was up in the thousand, but I think it was certainly up in the 600-700 ranges. But I really don't know the answer to that that question. One thing I do want to say, though, speaking of numbers. Kirk told me that last week, either prior to this program or after this program, there was a prolonged discussion led really by three individuals.
I think we just lost Craig.
We lost him? Yeah.
Yeah, he's not showing up on the switchboard anymore.
Okay.
Second, he should call back in, hopefully.
Yeah, hopefully.
Hopefully.
Well, what he was talking about, there was a discussion. Two individuals on that particular show, or that not a show, but that particular get-together, And one of them was Roy, as we know from Australia, who is a doctor.
Really smart guy.
Very smart guy. And also has a love affair with physics and is an extraordinarily learned man. And Jake is the one who wrote the rainbow, the letter that we all got about the rainbow. He is, and I may be wrong on this, because I'm new to Skyping with these guys. And Jake is, at least part of his life, I know he's been a designer, so he is very, very good with color. And I'm as an artist, I'm always using subtracting colors because I'm mixing dirt, but he was talking about how light and rainbows and all. And he was the one that wrote that information down, and he was brilliant, I thought. And they had a long discussion about it, and it was fascinating. I just sat like a fly on the wall and asked questions occasionally, but it was extremely good. And hopefully, I think where Yada was going, hopefully they will do a program themselves. So
and
I look forward
exactly
to that. Oh, I'm sorry. Did I interrupt?
Yeah, no, I'm glad you filled in. That's what you just said was what I was going to share. And what we're hoping is that the three of you guys can find the time that Scott Burdink, Scott is the person who is recording these programs so that we can host them. Time that you all can do a series of programs with Scott, because they were, from what I heard, spectacular. And that's one of the things I do want to do. I know, Roy, you've sent and Jackie has edited your evolution chapter. I really want to get to it and read that. And so there's lots of things here to do. But if you guys would record a show or two on evolution and a show or two on light, and say maybe a show on light, show on evolution or two, and then a show on dimensions, I think all of that would be wonderful to listen to it.
I'd love to listen to it, yeah.
So that's anyway what I wanted to share. Now, why don't we turn, unless there's something else that you guys want to add.
Can I ask one quick question before we get into it?
Sure.
Terry was reading Jeremiah today, and I was she was reading from a Christian Bible, and then I was also going through on looking at the words that are dramatically different. And I know Larry always talks about they hit him up with fear, you know, fear of God, because that's in Jeremiah in the English Bible. And I looked that up, and we talked about that a little bit, and that's the word. It is fear, but it can be translated as fear, but it's basically the throw. It's yara. And as you know, yara is also what we use for teaching. And in the oldest definition I could find, and then correct me if I'm wrong on this one, it is to throw something, as is to like to point your finger in a direction to walk or in a direction to live. And it's obviously with a hand reaching down, a yod, and then a ra, and a person paying attention, yara, the r, the rosh, and then a finishing off with a person standing up, the hey, engaged, walking, lifting up, looking at what's being said or looking in the direction of Yahweh. So I don't see. I know Hebrew words can have a negative as well as a positive effect. But why is it always fear?
It is. There are times when Yahweh can be translated fear.
Fear, yes.
But Yahweh's primary meaning is to revere and to respect. And you are right in terms of it is the hand, an open hand. Reaching down and out. It is a observant person whose eyes and ears are open to what's happening around, and mind is processing what they're hearing, and a person standing up and paying attention. There are really two reasons we know that when Yari is used in association with Yahweh, you have to choose the revere and respect definition. Is because of the fact that Yahweh says that fear of him is a religious tradition taught by rote. So he does not want to be feared. But the more important reason is that it's inconsistent with everything else he has to say about himself and what he's trying to accomplish. And so you don't kneel down and love to lift someone up, Barak, if you want them to bow down to you in fear. There is no place where Yahweh tells us that he thinks it would be a swell idea for us to fear him. Now, most Hebrew words do have a dark and light side, so that context defines how you translate them. And Yareh is one of those examples because of the fact that if you do not revere and respect Yahweh, you will fear him.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's like Ana, which the primary definition is to answer and respond. But Ana can also mean afflict. Mm-hmm. If you answer and respond to Yahweh's invitations, then your soul will not be afflicted. But it will be afflicted to the sense of, you know, not existing, being diminished to nothingness.
A pretty big
affliction. You don't respond to the invitation, yes. So one of the beauties of Hebrew is that the meaning of a word is only obvious if you're reading it in context from the right perspective. That's why perspective and context and using good judgment is so essential to translating and understanding Yahweh's nature. I think if I were to list by priority the most important and the least important skill sets to apply or techniques to apply to translating, I would say that the single most important technique that you can deploy, stratagem to deploy, if you want to translate what Yahweh is saying, is knowing who he is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you do not know him, I don't think you can effectively translate what he has to say.
No, I don't either. That's why I don't listen to these big experts. I really don't, because I read their commentaries, and they use words like holy and this and that. And I said, well, you know, he really doesn't have anything to teach me. He's misleading people. I don't think I'll give him any business. And, and I don't.
Personally, using the term Bible, or they're using Old Testament or New Testament, or they're using Lord in association with God. They don't know his name. They want people to obey. They think that the Torah is law. Most of what we've just said, you can't even derive from the words if you try to translate them accurately. But there are words that, like Yari, that have just been mentioned, that do have multiple meanings, a dark and light side. It's the nature of Yahweh's testimony to present it that way, because he wants you to think through and he wants you to recognize that with every thing, there is a consequence. With every choice you make, there is a consequence. Some of those consequences are beneficial. Some of the consequences are not. And therefore, it's extremely important to know that when Yahweh invites us to become part of his covenant family and enriches us and empowers us, the very last thing he wants is for us to fear him. And
I would say the second most important thing in translating is context. You absolutely cannot translate a verse out of context of the whole. It does not work. You will never get a proper translation ever.
Yeah, I would say that. I would agree. The first is you got to know Yahweh. You have to understand the Torah, and you have to translate what he has to say from that perspective. Never contradicting his nature, his purpose, his plan. And so that's the single most important thing, and the second is context. I think if I were to give a third, my third would be having an open mind and open eyes, so that you do not ever think that you have a accurate and complete translation of a word with the first thing you read in the first lesson. And my advice for those who want to translate is, do not be satisfied ever that you really have a comprehensive understanding of a word. Always look deeper. And the ways that you look deeper is, you look beyond the Masoretic diacritical markings. So you look at the base letters that comprise the words, not the markings that differentiate words written exactly the same way. Always look at the actionable or the verbal root of words. Always consider the history of those words. If a word is a bit challenging, look at how Yahweh uses the word initially in his Torah, and then the second and third time that he deploys the word. And then look in many different lexicons, and every word that's related to that word, consider. So I think the third most important skill is a passion for this vocabulary, and the willingness with an open mind and open eyes to constantly dig deep and never be satisfied with the with what you have learned. Always try to learn more as it relates to every.
Another good tip. Go look at multiple places where the word is used and see if the translation you're using fits. You know, does it fit in 2 out of 3? Does it fit in 10 out of 10? And yeah, there are some words you're going to find where, like you said, there are multiple sides, and, you know, about 60% of the time it's this, 40% it's that. But, you know, if one time it fits, and then, like, every other time it's used, it does not fit, you know, you mentioned earlier I'm drawing a banah, you know, the afflict yourself does not fit, but maybe 5% of the time. Whereas answer and respond fits 100% of the time. You look at multiple times where it's used. You really understand how that word is used.
Or afflictions versus reconciliation.
I wouldn't actually say that. What I would say is that in Anah, answer and respond fits 95% of the time.
Yeah.
And somewhere between 1 and 5% of the time, afflict is the proper translation of the word. Some form of afflict is the proper translation of the word. It's about 95.5. 95% of the time, it absolutely, in context, cannot be translated afflict. But there are a few times where afflict is a proper meaning. Now, the word was designed to have a dark and light side, just like yare. You know, yare,
the same ratio
about 90% of the time that yare is used, and 100% of the time it's associated with Yahweh, it has to be a translated rear and respect.
You know, that right there gives you a difference between Yahweh and the religious God. 90%, 95% of the time, the good meaning is intended.
Correct.
It would be the complete opposite if you look at any religious text. 95% of the time, they're translating it the dark way.
Well, the scribes always take the low road.
God is a dark God.
Keep in mind, Yahweh uses terms like Elohim to not only present his title, but also to describe false deity. And the Torah is not just comprised of happy news. It's not just comprised of, this is the marvelous things I did to create the universe and to create life, and then to engage in a relationship with Adam, and then Noah, and then Abraham, and it was all peaches and cream, and everything was just special. That's not the nature of the text. The text has all of the positives, but it has an equal amount of negatives. You know, because it wasn't all peaches and cream. Yeah, you know, Yahweh says, I grieve that I created man. He was evil all of the time. And so you have to have words that have negative implications. Otherwise, you could not discuss the dark side of the consequence of choosing the religious or political or militaristic institution. So it's there. It's just never associated with Yahweh.
If you were doing it for the first time, gosh, it would blow you away. You can't find anything but fear.
Right.
That's worth it. I've never understood the term God-fearing. I'm a God-fearing Christian. Well, you're in a complete wrong mindset if you want to know and love God.
Well, you're actually the Christian's right to fear God.
Oh, they should.
Yeah, in context, you're absolutely right.
They should.
Well, actually, what Yahweh said.
By the way, the Christian God is fearsome, because the fearsome God is going to make sure that anyone who doesn't capitulate to him roasts forever in hell. So he is pretty fearsome.
Yeah.
but fearing God is not something you should strive for.
You know, one of the things about the covenant is the complete sense of relaxation that is associated with it. You know, Yahweh uses the term variations of Shabbat to speak of us resting, of us coming to a place of settling down and resting and relaxing. And that is it's something I really didn't have an appreciation for until I came to dwell on the idea that God wants us to relax around Him.
By the way, just hearing Yashayah 63:17, another one where Yashayah points out, you know, the downside of fear. Yahweh, we have wandered away, staggering in our intoxication. Now, we know what that is. Intoxication doesn't mean that they drank too much. It means that their judgment skills were poor.
Mm-hmm.
Erring from your way, hardening our hearts out of yirah. It certainly wasn't out of respect. It was out of fear. And that's right there. And return for the sake of your servants, which are few, really. So, Yahweh, we have wandered away, staggering in our intoxication, erring from your way, hardening our hearts out of fear. So, fear is never associated with Yahweh, but it certainly is associated with Baal.
Many and associated with wandering away from Yahweh.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, which
is associated with hardening your heart. Because a heart that is hard is going to fear. A heart that is receptive is going to love.
Yeah, you don't think clearly when you're afraid. You just don't. You can't.
No.
You can't.
No, that's why people use torture. That's why they use terror. Terror is an effective technique because people who are afraid can be easily manipulated. They're not thinking in their response. They're simply responding to the fear of terror that it will happen to them. So there's almost no thinking in response to terror, to fear.
Well, to your point,
but they use it. If you get people not thinking, it's easier to control and manipulate them.
Right. That's the whole concept of both Islam, which is Muhammad said, I become victorious through terror. You can cause people to capitulate through fear. The Quran says, he who fears will obey. And so Islam was predicated upon fear. But so was Roman Catholicism. Machiavelli, who wrote the textbook, the playbook for Roman Catholicism, made it very clear that the ends justify the means and that the best means to control, to elicit power for oneself, was terror.
Well, predating all of that, you have the religious concept of heaven and hell, the carrot and stick.
Correct.
Yeah, that's all fear-based.
You know,
heaven is never described. I mean, heaven is never described. What's
hell is always described in detail.
Would be miserable. But hell is the one that is always depicted. Because all you have of heaven in the religious lore of Christianity is the pearly gates. There is never a picture of what it's like to be in heaven.
They let everyone describe that with their own mind. But they
Right, and you're always on the wrong side of the pearly gates, which means you're just a wisp of a cloud away from the thing that they have depicted, which is hell. And they've always depicted hell as anguishing and menacing and burning.
And inferno.
Right. Yeah, this inferno. So it is out of fear that they solicit your money and your soul and your participation, and it empowers and enriches them. And, of course, for most of its existence, both the Roman Empire and the Roman Catholic Church that grew out of it, their principal control mechanism was always fear.
Mm-hmm.
They terrorized those that did not capitulate. And the reason they invented crucifixion was specifically to cause terror, to cause fear, to make anyone afraid of rebelling against them. If you knew that to rebel against the Roman Catholic Church in Rome was to be crucified, you'd have to leave. Yeah, not many people are going to make that choice.
I had a conversation one time. This was many, many years ago. I was still very atheist agnostic, but it was with a Christians on campus group at my college. And there's, I've seen this several other places now, so it's, I guess it's like a thing that God convicts you with the Ten Commandments. The whole idea is convince you that you're going to go to hell because every single one of us has violated one of the Ten Commandments. But the whole thing is based on that fear. You know, and the guy tried to tell me, you know, well, Jesus spoke of hell more than anything else. Which, you know, now I would look at what Yahweh just said and say, no, he didn't. But back then I was like, well, then why the heck would I want to know the guy? Yeah. That was my response as an atheist was, you know, okay. You know, he may have. I don't believe in this guy, so what do I care? And why would I want to know a guy whose preoccupation is with hell?
Yeah, of course, you know, the two things that strike me about that argument is that there's only one of the ten statements that says that there is no forgiveness from this act. The other nine do not have any statement regarding a lack of forgiveness. I mean, the first one tells us that Yahweh is our liberator, but the Christian New Testament tells us that the Torah enslaves. So we have a direct contradiction there. So that doesn't work if you're a Christian. And then the second says that fathers corrupt their own children to the fourth and fifth generation, and yet it says that mercy is applicable, available to those who closely examine and carefully consider the instructions and conditions associated with the covenant. The third, those who negate the value of Yahweh's name, those who promote Yahweh as
faithless, steal and cover up,
right, will not be forgiven.
You got to love how Christians have interpreted that to be, that one, every Christian interprets the same way. Don't say God damn.
Well,
they say that's a violation of the third commandment. So in their view, saying God damn is the one thing he won't forgive. He'll forgive you for murder, lying, adultery, you name it, but if you say God damn, he won't forgive that. That's the Christian God for you right there.
Doesn't that make the Christian God a moron?
Well, their interpretation
does
exactly what that instruction says not to do. It completely ignores God's name.
That instruction had a huge influence over my life. So I'm glad that is their interpretation. And when I wrote Tea with Terrorists, it has the president of, I think it's actually the general, in speaking to the president, say God damn, and God damn appears on either the second or third page of Tea with Terrorists. And the book was thrown out of Christian bookstores and returned to the distributor because of the use of God damn, and I was told that it was taken out because it was a violation of the third commandment. And so, you know, at the time, I was just coming to know the Hebrew and the Torah, but I knew that that it didn't say that you can't say God damn.
Well, it makes no sense.
Sorry, folks. Your mistake, but it didn't matter. I mean, Yahweh's testimony was irrelevant. An accurate translation of the statement was irrelevant. That is their belief that God is that. Their God is that ridiculous. But why would they even care what the commandments say? And by the way, there are no commandments, but forget that for a moment. Why would they care what they say when the author of half of their New Testament says that the Torah has no value and it cannot save? So is the purpose of the Torah to condemn?
That's their view. Well, that was Paul's view.
So Yahweh wrote the Torah. Okay, so the God who created the universe authored the Torah specifically to condemn his creation.
Yes, that's the Christian view right there.
So why would you want to know that kind of
God? Not one of them will admit to it, but that's their view.
Yeah, so why would you want to know that kind of God?
I want it. That's why I was an atheist for most of my life. The religious God abhorred me. I couldn't stand the religious God. I wanted nothing to do with it. My only regret is that I pinned all that on the real God.
I saw a movie not too long ago where they had a atheist speaking to this moronic military guy that was a fundamentalist Christian and an active army. And the woman was an atheist that was talking to him. And one of the comments she made would say, you know, one of the big issues I have with your religion is that why would I want to have a relationship with a God that's more insecure than I am? This notion of a God that wants to be worshipped paints a picture of a God even more insecure than the most insecure person. For that, he had no answer. But that is the basis of religion, you know, this, that God wants you to bow down to him, that he wants you to worship him. What kind of an insecure deity is that? All right, let's turn to back to where we were in the story of Noah.
So we're getting into Noah. I'd just like to add some here. I asked a question earlier. Elise Babinier just sent me this. She said he lived 350 years after the deluge. That means he was a total of 950 years when he passed on. And that's
my guess. 900 wasn't too far off.
950. It wasn't. This is what I find interesting there. That's exactly, that means he was born exactly one yovel after Adam and Chawa were ejected from the garden and were to use the yovel for the count, right? I mean, that's what Yahusha did. He went right to Yahusha Yah saying, look, here's the yovel. So,
yeah. Wow.
Isn't that interesting?
So exactly. The next yovel, he had the solution.
Isn't that wild? I mean, or at least that's what I picked up in that, because 50 years, I mean, I know nothing's an accident in this. That's exactly one yovel, so there we go.
You see, I think that that Adam was 70 years shy of 1,000, and I think that now we're saying that Noah was 50 years shy of 1,000, and so he was one yovel, and Noah was one set of 70. You know, they very important markers in terms of time. With Adam, it would require all seven steps to get us back home. And with Noah, he was presenting the plan of the Yobel, which is that this is the time of man's redemption, the time that debts are forgiven and that slaves are freed and that that we return to the land and that the land becomes Yahweh's. All marvelous insights. So there is a reason for everything, isn't there?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I know when it comes to numbers, that there's something always to look at, and the only thing I know that's 50 years is a yovel. That's it.
That's right. Yeah, and it's no small potatoes, and the that's one of the things that it's so surprising to me. You know that. About a month ago, the pathetic piece of worm rot that is dressed up in the clown suit as the Pope, Bergoglio.
Bergoglio. You should be a PR man. I'm telling you, you're getting dead on there.
Yeah,
worm rot.
Respond to the piece of worm rot. He opened the special doors to the Catholic Church and announced that it was a Jubilee year.
Oh, really?
And of course, this Jubilee is a corruption of Yobel. And so this piece of worm rot thinks that that he and his church have been entrusted with establishing the times that Yahweh will redeem and save humankind. And he thinks his church can pick the years whenever he and his church want to. But the Yobel is established in stone. It is something, a countdown that began the moment that Adam and Chawa were booted out of the garden, because it is the countdown. It's the means of determining precisely when every important act related to humankind's ultimate reconciliation occurs with God. And the point I was going to make is that apart from the utter hubris of the Roman Catholic Church and to a lesser degree, the royalty of England, declaring jubilees. There is almost no mention anywhere of the Obel. In fact, I think that unless you were to specifically look for it and to specifically try to say, wow, everything that happens on not only a Yobel year, but on very important Yobel years, particularly the most important dates in human history, are 40 Yobel,
40 because
plus 40 Yobel, and 40 plus 40 plus 40 Yobel. You know, the first 2,000 years from Adam and Chawa exiting Eden is the time that the means to return to Eden was established via the covenant. And then 2,000 years exactly out of that is the fourth day when Yosha enabled the first four Moed Mikre expressly to provide the benefits of that very plan that Yahweh established with Abraham at the first marker of 40 Yobel. And at 40 plus 40 plus 40 Yobel, he returns to reconcile his relationship with his children and begin the millennial Shabbat.
You just hit 120 there. You just hit 120 there, too, which is another, just something else crossed my mind. How long did he say that the oldest person could live after the deluge? Wasn't it 120 years? Everybody says 100, but it wasn't 100. It was 120.
Isn't that very
something?
Very, very fixated on his Yobel. And the Yobel were specifically designed for a purpose. And the purpose is to free man from being slaves to human institutions, being slaves to other men, to forgive all of our debts, and to return us to the promised land. That's what occurs on the Yobel. And to not celebrate that, to not be completely ignorant of it. I don't think, and you guys can correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think there is a Christian prophecy expert on the planet.
No, there isn't.
That has ever written about the fact that Abraham's confirmation of the covenant with Yahweh took place at 40 Yobel from the Exodus from Eden, and that Yosha walking into to Jerusalem to fulfill the first four Moed Mikre occurred 40 Yobel thereafter, and that Yahweh is going to return on the Yobel year of 6,000 Yah, which is 40 Yobel after he fulfilled the first four Mikre, and he's going to fulfill the final two at that time. Without that understanding, you have no clue, no ability to establish Yahweh's timeline. You don't know history from his perspective.
Well, I've never even heard one of these experts mention a Yobel, by the way. Not ever. What? Not ever. Well,
I've read a ton of them, and they've never put that together.
By the way,
mentioned, but not in context.
You've heard them. Well, it's very rare that they even use that term. I think they use jubilee almost always. But
I've
never seen them use the term Yobel. And by the way, there's one other thing about Mr. Wormrot. Mr. Wormrot came out. This was about 6 months ago now, I think, or 8 months ago, where he said.
Wasn't even trusted by the Jesuits. Even imprisoned him.
They imprisoned him in a red room.
Out of control and power hungry.
You are out of your mind.
In jail.
You have to be out of your mind. But here's what Mr. Wormrot said. Jerome was wrong. It turned out that the crucifixion was years earlier. We've been wrong. Jerome was wrong. And of course,
I will tell you that Jerome was wrong about most everything that Jerome wrote about.
Jerome was wrong. Oh boy.
The fact is that if you want to know the timing of Yosha's fulfillment of Pesach. To call that the crucifixion is to besmirch the day. If you want to know the timing of Yosha's fulfillment of Pesach, there is a very straight way, a straightforward way of going about it.
Daniel.
It will take you some time. I'm going to tell you, it's going to, you know, you're going to need your calculator or a big piece of paper so you can do your long multiplication. But yes, you turn to Daniel, and Daniel presents the time of the arrival of the Messiah. Now, you're also going to have a history book, and you're going to have to know when the starting date is. But the only question on the starting date is it 444 BCE or 445 BCE? And since this is so important to get to the right date in this particular case, most people use 445.
And it's 444.
I chose to use 444 because I studied the history of Xerxes' death and the subsequent rise in the battle between his sons to understand when Artaxerxes was able to claim the throne. And it took a year for the deaths and espionage and all of that stuff to transpire. And so you then go from the 20th year after 444 BCE establishes the date. But you can only be off by 1 year because the date of Xerxes' death is 445 BCE, and so the 20th year of Artaxerxes has to be either 20 years from then or 20 years from the time that he actually claimed the throne after all of the intrigue transpired in Babylon slash Assyria. So from that point, all you do now is you're going to multiply the number of sevens that Daniel specifies, and at that point there's only one option, only one thing that you have to consider. Are you going to use solar years, 365 and a quarter days, which wasn't even a concept, by the way, in the ancient Hebrew mindset. There's no place where it talks about a solar year being 365 and a quarter days. Or are you going to use the prophetic year, which is 360 days? And if you go to Yahweh's first use of when he presents time and in a year and from a prophetic point of view, he's using the prophetic year of 360 days. So you do have to make that determination. Once you make that determination and you use the 360, what you end up with is that Yosha walks into Jerusalem 4 days before Pesach and what we would call the year 33 CE, which is year 4000 Yah. And 4 days before Pesach is when the Passover lamb would walk into the, would come into the home.
And, into the home, yeah.
Right. And so that is 4 days before Passover. And you can go back and look at the moon phases. I've done it for 33 CE. And the Monday that he walked into town was is that day in 33 CE. It was a Monday, because Pesach was celebrated that Thursday night. And that's when he had dinner with his disciples, and all of the eyewitnesses say that it was Thursday night that he had dinner with his disciples. He had suffered as the Pesach lamb on Friday. On Friday night was the preparation time, so they were, and it was a preparation for two things. It was not just a normal Shabbat, but it was also the special Shabbat of Matzah. And so they were. We know that the Shabbat followed, and that's when he, his soul went into Sheol to pay our ransom, and then the first day of the week, then before sunrise, which would have been the first day of the week from the Hebrew mindset, not from our mindset today, but from the Hebrew mindset, the first day of the week is when we celebrated first fruits. It corresponds with the eyewitness accounts. It corresponds with the proper days of the week. It corresponds with the lunar calendar in terms of dating Pesach that year. And it's exactly 1,000 years from the lane of the cornerstone of the temple, which is a date that is known, 967 BCE. It's exactly 1,000 years from that point. And so when you look at...
There's one other thing to throw in here. So if we're going 40 Yobel, because 40
right.
is completion, and we're going 40 Yobel from that point, that takes us to 2033. And here's
right.
why I am 100%. There's two reasons.
The fact that these things line up are not coincidence.
Here's a big lineup. Sukkah, when we celebrate Shabbat tonight, it's a foreshadowing of the plan, and it's really a foreshadowing of Sukkah, is it not? I mean, the seventh day of rest is a foreshadowing of Sukkah. Now,
Shabbat
the year
and Sukkah are coterminous. They're alike. Even
coterminous.
The Shabbat
yes, I
and
like
Sukkah
that.
Are all coterminous concepts.
In the year 2033,
right.
what day does Sukkah begin?
Well, of course, Dave, it's Shabbat. Well, Friday night.
Perfectly. Yeah, and it's the only one that does for several years
correct.
On either side
correct.
Of that. So we're right
and
there
and
at
what,
the
and,
perfect
and in 30,
time.
And in 33 CE, the Shabbat of Matzah, what day do you think it fell on?
That was a Shabbat.
Yeah. Of course. And that's another affirmation of the time. Another affirmation is that Rabbi Akiva promoted Bar Kokhba as the false Messiah in year 133 because it was the Yobel year. And that's why 133 to 135 was the rebellion with Rome.
Yeah, and he knew they'd better come up with a Messiah. And the only thing he could do is say we were 100 years off. That's
right. That was the last Yobel recorded and celebrated in Yisrael, because you know anybody who could speak Hebrew was burned alive with the Torah wrapped around them. So every copy they could find of the Torah was destroyed. Everybody who could read Hebrew was murdered. All the records were destroyed. It was the last time the Yobel was celebrated in Yisrael. 133 C. Another affirmation.
See, these are a lot of confirmations here. A lot of
confirmations here.
Yep.
You know, while there's been Mickey Mousing with the calendar and the switch to the Julian calendar, and then the later switch to the Gregorian calendar, and so the calendar that we use today is extremely corrupted and pagan and Roman in its nature, but when you look at Yahweh's timeline and how he set up the 7 days, and the seventh day being the Shabbat, the seventh day being the celebration of Sukkah for 1,000 years here on earth, and how it begins with Eden and then it ends in Eden, and that the fourth day is when the greater light becomes visible as a sign of the Moed, and Yosef fulfills the first four Moed. And year 4000 Yah, and that's 33 CE. The numbers here are such that if you're a rational, thinking individual who is informed, and you intermix the majesty of the seven invitations to be called out and to meet with Yahweh, with the Yobel, that if you do those things, and you consider the timing that we're presented with the flood, with Abraham and Mount Moriah, with Dod and the temple, with Yosha coming into Jerusalem as it's played out, as presented by Daniel, and then of the final Shabbat and what's going to happen to Israel being reestablished, that that generation will witness his return. And knowing that that generation will coincide with year 6000 Yah, 2033, when you put all that together, if it doesn't move you to conviction, then evidence and reason don't matter.
Yeah, can I throw in one more thing? When Yao Khan in 68 or 9 CE wrote about Pinthos, Apophis, the asteroid that is due to hit this planet, It's midway through the tribulation, April 13th, 2029.
Yeah.
You know, you're right there. You know, talk about another affirmation. You know, that's astounding.
You know, Yohanan didn't write Revelation in Greek. But the Greek translation of the word that was used is balo. And balo means to nudge, to move. And so, well, right now, NASA will tell you that the numbers of Asbestos, of Apophis, which is the name of the Greek god, not the Greek, but the Egyptian god of
Egyptian,
darkness. Yeah. The Egyptian god of darkness and death. And it's interesting that we're going right back to all the things that Yahweh hated about the religion of Egypt. And kind of a plague of mankind. You know, this is another plague, Egypt-based plague, religious-based plague. But it is interesting that scientists will tell us that the math says that based upon its orbit, that it will come inside of our satellite rings, which means it could well knock out who knows how many satellites. But they're saying that it's going to come within side of our satellite rings. That's how close it's going to come to Earth. And yet, at the same time, NASA has requested and has been given a very large budget to move it.
Yeah,
so
I know.
The only time that NASA has been given money actually to figure out how to deflect an asteroid is because of MN 2004, Apophis. And so there is still great concern that somewhere in its orbit, another piece of debris doesn't have to hit it. It's just that something else, we're talking about fractions of a second. I mean, billions upon billions of on its arc and trajectory or speed, and it hits rather than misses. And that's what Yahweh conveyed when he says, Balo. It's going to be nudged. Somewhere along the way.
Can I further this discussion by something?
Yeah.
I have a theory, and it's just me talking. But as I read the last four, the big four plagues that are, or the four horrible things that are going to happen, I don't think Yah has to do much of anything. I mean, we can bring the plague on ourselves. We can destroy the world, or so much of the world, with a nuclear war.
And probably
we can move that thing accidentally and send it in there. That's man-made. Even if it hits the satellite, it's man-made. It causes that. The nuclear weapons could easily hit certain areas where there are earthquakes and do that. I mean, we're pretty much our own enemy. I don't think Yahweh likes to kill things, you know. He didn't wipe out the Earth with Noah. He never has wiped out the Earth. He likes animals. He likes people.
Yeah, I think you're right.
I see us killing the world. He comes in, he says, at the last minute to save us from destroying
everything. I do think that prior to the midpoint in the tribulation, that 100% of what happens to humankind is the result of humankind being evil most all of the time, just like what we read here in Genesis regarding Barashit, regarding Noah's associates, those political beasts that were around it. And so almost everything is natural. I think that the asteroid is natural. I think that the side of the mountain in the Canary Islands slipping into the sea and causing the tidal wave is natural. I think the flood was created by a natural event.
It wasn't. Yahweh didn't let that destroy the whole earth. He just the region.
No.
And he saved the people that go turn to him.
Right. Yes, that is correct. And I don't think Yahweh intervenes nearly as much as most people think. Right.
Yeah.
And I do think that he calculated his creation of the universe such that our solar system and life here on it in the history of man would play out over this specific period of time. I think it was the initial calculation that he used to create things that is going to have it play out over this period of time. Now, he has already given his family a means of avoiding a consequence of that asteroid, a consequence, avoiding the consequence of that tidal wave.
Called Tarua.
Right, mm-hmm. Yeah. So he's given us
Tarua,
the out. And for those who come to know him, understand the covenant, and act upon it in the first 3.5 years of the tribulation, even though they will, in all likelihood, die from it, they will their souls will transition into eternity. So they only have a very brief, short consequence of being late to the party, if you will. Mm-hmm. But I think one of the reasons he tells us all these disastrous things are coming is that he does want to bring this all to a conclusion, because as I read the, and I'm not claiming I'm right here, just this is my take on it, but as I read the tribulation, I think that the first 3.5 years, free will as it currently exists continues to exist. I think in the last 3.5 years, once the mark of the beast, once the Sunday law is established, once the new currency and the new world order are perpetrated by the Torahless one, that one's allegiance to or disassociation from that satanic order will determine your fate. If you choose the mark, if you choose the financial aspects of it, if you choose allegiance, it's over.
There's no more sitting at that point.
Right.
There's no more choice.
Sure.
You know, it's
because the decision is so clear at that point. You have option A or option B. There is no I don't know. There's not enough information. Right. I don't feel like looking it up. There's no excuse. It's A or B at that point.
You know, there was a time in my life when I chose to be a Republican and political. There was a time in my life when I chose to be a Christian and evangelical. If I had made those decisions in 2030, it would be over for me. But I made those decisions at a time that I still had the opportunity to renounce them. And I don't think that opportunity to renounce them will be in effect after sometime in 2029, 2030. Sometime in that period, once the mark of the beast and allegiance to that satanic order is presented, and if, for those that accept it, I think it is over.
That's with the exception of those in Jerusalem.
It will be cloudy and muddy. With the exception of those in Jerusalem, they will have much more information to base it on. They won't have the ignorance excuse that we have now.
I don't think those in Jerusalem.
Clear cut.
Yeah, I don't think that the Yehudim and the Israelites, I don't think they accept the mark of the beast.
No, they couldn't.
Well, they couldn't.
No, I think they reject it.
Yeah, that's why the whole world's attacking
them. Out at this point.
Yeah, I think they reject it.
Yeah, they'll be the only large group.
They reject it in large numbers. Yeah, I think they reject it in large numbers.
And that's why the whole world comes against them.
Right. You know, if you wanted just another confirmation of the time, Isaiah 17 is extraordinarily clear about the sinning of Israel at the waist is what leads to the unified Islamic attack on Israel. And it follows immediately after the destruction of Damascus and the fall of Syria as a nation. And for us to watch what's happening right now in Syria and how that is unifying Muslims and how the world is pressing Israel to give up the West Bank to appease the Muslims. You're reading that occurring in our very midst, and there is no way that you could come to any other conclusion than the one that is presented in Isaiah 17. And it's being manifest before our eyes, and it's timeline. There is no way to push that timeline out more than 15 years. You just can't get there. In fact, you couldn't push it out 10 years if the Russians hadn't stupidly engaged on behalf of Assad. Now, I'm not saying that Assad is worse than the jihadists that are opposing him. He's not, although he's a horrible dictator. But the fact is that that had the Russians not engaged in this war,
Syria would have come much sooner.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and we would be premature. And so as you watch all these things happen, you just go, oh, my goodness. I mean, you're reading the affirmation of prophecy being fulfilled before our eyes. And then when it says that the second phase of Magog leads to the destruction of one-third of the oceans, one-third of the land, and that,
you know that's nuclear. You know it's
right.
nuclear.
And, but you also know that it's world war. And how do you see the Syrian war being manifest right now? Russia and China and the Shiites on one side and Saudi Arabia, Turkey, the United States, and Europe on the other. World war.
Yeah, yeah. And by the way, vis-a-vis the Pope, the Shias, you know, have to go. You understand that. See, that Sunnis do not have a Pope, as it were. But Shias
right.
do.
Correct.
And there can't be a challenge to the Pope. Yeah, there just can't be. See, that's the whole thing. He's
yeah.
the spokesman for God.
Yeah, you
so,
see, though,
I don't say the Shias going
thing.
Away.
Yeah, I mean, we first of all, we know that, and this is kind of a two-sided coin here. We know that Yahweh's view of the most menacing beast in human history is the Roman Catholic Church.
Right.
And the second most menacing beast
Our
was Imperial Rome.
Saint. Yep.
Yes, and it's the seat of Satan. It's married to the Lord. It is dead, but it is extraordinarily menacing, the Roman Catholicism, and that it continues to endure. But the false prophet for the Torahless one, he's not the Pope.
No, he's not.
Right.
But the false prophet throws his weight behind the.
The
false prophet is probably the Pope, Paul, Muhammad, whatever.
Well, you know, one of the things that we learned just a couple
murder.
Of weeks ago or 3 weeks ago when we were starting to study and consider the rainbow even more thoroughly because of the fact that there is a crystalline rainbow behind the Ark of the Covenant today, is that what Ron Wyatt was told is something very different than what he wrote. He wrote that the tablets would be displayed, and his wife told me, that widow told me, those tablets would be displayed in association with the Mark of the Beast. And that's not, and Ron Wyatt on his deathbed twice said, I need to correct the record. That is not what the Malach said. He said those tablets are going to be displayed at the time that the Sunday law is established. And so what he is saying is that the Torahless one, when he's establishing and changing the times, he is establishing Christianity.
Yeah.
I think Islam as a religion becomes almost meaningless at the after Magog. I think that when Yahweh intervenes to save Yisrael from Magog, that's it for the universal power and influence of Islam. And the Islamic oil fields are just become fireballs. So Yahweh ends the threat of Islam at that point. And the more I studied Paul, the more I read Yahweh's proclamations that Paul was the plague of death, the more I came to be convinced that the Torahless one, the Antichrist, the model
very
for him
Christ.
He is going to be possessed by the same demon that possessed Paul.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to have exactly the same mantra.
Yeah,
Christians are going to love him. He's going to establish the Sunday law. He's going to.
And he'll be pro Christ. There is no
right.
Antichrist.
And then when you,
there's man
right, right. and when you think of Yahweh describing the beast. And he says that the last beast that grows out of the previous beast, and of course he uses the lowly and little horn, we're talking about Paul again. But when he talks about how the Torahless one is in his nature, and then he talks about the beast that grows out of Rome, which is Roman Catholicism, being the most vicious of all beasts, trampling upon the whole world. What did Rome and the Roman Catholic Church do. They outlawed the Shabbat. They outlawed the Torah. They outlawed everything associated with Yahweh and imposed the Sunday law.
Yes, they do.
The Torahless one is going
to establish
right, is going to establish Christianity just as it exists in Roman Catholicism. Yep, that is. It's another.
I think we recall in Babylon that the solar deity was Lord Baal, and the national lunar deity was Sin, and he was worshipped in the form of the crescent moon. So really, the two religions were one. And I think that the two religions merge in the end, and I think that's why you've got people literally yelling Allah. And by the way, the Pope says, you know, he outlawed the use of Yahweh's name, but Allah's okay. He said,
yeah.
And speaking of Allah,
two religions merge. I mean, I'm.
Well, he said that Roman Catholics and Muslims are brothers.
According to the Pope.
Yeah, he's.
And they do.
He is.
They do. I didn't know he did.
This Pope, the Mr. Wormrot, he is desperately trying to establish his dominance, his influence, recognizing that his church is dying, and it's dying an ugly, ugly death. And so the only way that he can do so is to somehow incorporate Islam and socialist secular humanism into being three coterminous bedfellows. And that was the obvious conclusion.
The
evil trinity really is socialist secular humanism, this imposed version of Roman Catholicism and Christianity, along with Sunni Islam.
Yeah, and that's what I think happens. I'm convinced.
Well, the leadership of Islam, though, would be pretty much wiped out, so there would be an easy picking for them to talk him into it. A lot more than it would
be.
Yeah,
they're not wiped out, though, until...
No, not in numbers, but they're certainly in their hierarchy and their team.
Reading between the lines, I suspect that because of... the United States arming both sides, and because of Iran being able to complete their nuclear ambitions and being released of all the sanctions and therefore having the money to buy the weaponry and being backed by Russia and China, that Shia Islam survives well into the tribulation, and that Sunni Islam is going to be the Magog War. And that Shia Islam is going to be part of the Chinese assault that is Armageddon. So I think that Shia Islam is going to survive Sunni Islam.
Interesting. I thought the opposite.
My first thought was that because Shia Islam is outmanned 5-1 and outgunned 25-1, that Sunni Islam, with the Islamic State et al., would destroy Shia Islam. But the fact is that there is no way for Sunni Islam... Right, there is no way for Sunni Islam...
I think when they get nuclear bombs, they'll be out of the picture until they come back later.
That is correct. So once the Iranians complete their nuclear ambition, and they will soon, that Iran... becomes Iran, along with Baghdad and Eastern Iraq, then Iran and Eastern Iraq can no longer be invaded by Sunni Islam. And so, but the Sunnis are going to continue to prevail. After the Sunnis destroy Damascus and bring Syria down, which means that the Iranians are going to lose their influence there, the next place that the Sunni militants are going is Jordan, and we're told that Jordan is trampled underfoot.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would think they would have to go to Lebanon, too, because of Hezbollah.
Yeah, they're only going to... Their issues in Lebanon are different. They're going to Jordan because in Jordan they won't have to... Their fight will be fast, it will be easy, and all of their subjects are Sunni Muslims. And so they will be in the same situation they're in Ramallah and Mosul. But in Lebanon, there's a lot of Shiites. The last thing they want to go is to a place that is full of Shiites. They will go into Saudi Arabia, and they will prevail.
And so, what happens to the house of Saud?
So I think that they, and then with Egypt, you've got Sunni Muslims and the Islamic State now very strong in Libya and very strong in the Sinai in Egypt. And so Egypt gets a pincer effect, and the Muslims there are going to want to join with the Islamic State, as will all the Sunnis around the world in the great assault of Israel. But those Sunnis would just as soon kill a Shia as they would have the Shia fight alongside with them. So
yeah,
I think
absolutely.
Iran actually is impervious to invasion because of its nuclear capability and because of the fact that Sunnis don't want them, and the Sunnis will have cut them off from Israel. So Iran, I think, survives, which is why they will participate along with the Chinese in Armageddon, because you realize that
when you bring up the Chinese, you're doing that because of the numbers. Is that correct?
No. Well, because of both their numbers, but also because of their location and the fact that the Chinese announced this year that they are committing $46 billion to building the largest roadway system in the history of the world. They're well underway in building it. But it's the first time that any civilization has had a thoroughfare through the Hindu Kush, which enables the Chinese to march all the way through. And they negotiated an agreement with the Pakistanis where they come straight through Pakistan. But guess what they have to do next to get to Israel? They got to go through Iran.
Mm-hmm.
But who are they already in bed with? Because the largest oil pipeline in the world and gas pipeline in the world is the one built through China to the Caspian Sea, controlled by Iran.
Not only that, they build dams in Iran too, and other things.
Right.
They're very, very involved in structure.
So the Iranians and the Chinese that are already linked together are going to, as I look at the way that history is playing out, I think they are Armageddon. And it's the Sunnis that Yahweh destroys when they attack Israel in first Armageddon, or first...
in the Gog-Magog.
Magog War, yeah.
Which will be Russia and them, I guess. That's who will be fighting.
Right now the Russians are on the side of Shia Islam, but
yes, they are.
The Russians are going to continue to back Iran. There is no chance that they won't, because of their gas and oil needs and their international trading partners. They'll continue to back Iran. But that does not mean that the Russians won't also back Sunni Muslims in their assault of Israel. And let me give you an example here. Right now, there's a lot of Sunni Muslims that are mad at Russia for fighting on behalf of Assad and Iran. However, all Russia would have to do to endear themselves to Sunni Muslims is to do the same thing in the West Bank and in Gaza that they did in Syria. Just one day, tell the world, oh, by the way, we've repositioned our fleet, and we've positioned X number of fighters and bombers and attack helicopters in the West Bank and in Gaza. And all of a sudden, they are the great hero of Sunni Islam, and they will be able to aid Sunni Islam in the Magog War. I think they play both sides.
Yeah.
Oh, well, sure. And major superpowers do that all the time. That wouldn't be a fun.
Well, America does it all the time. America is the worst.
100% of the time. Yep.
Well, let me throw in something else.
We're arming both sides and attacking both sides in the current Syrian war. And we started the war deliberately, purposefully.
Now, China's only reason to come through here is to get oil and gas and control of what's left in the world for resources, right?
What now? What did you say, Kirk?
They're going after the resources. I mean, I don't know whether y'all read the numbers, that what they found off the shores of Syria, Israel, Lebanon, and the Sinai. How much gas and you know what the numbers are that they're talking about? They're talking 20 to 25 trillion cubic feet of natural gas.
Right. And
600 million barrels of oil.
In the Galilee are as large, if not larger, than that.
Yeah. That's a conservative estimate. And when you think about the silliness of, now Saudi has, nobody would need Saudi Arabia's pipeline, and nobody needs Iran's pipeline.
Correct.
So Iran has to join China to be part of that.
But the world wants to shut down Israel's development of those fields. That is absolutely correct. But the Chinese have created a monster, if you will, and that is that with their economic prowess and their manufacturing prowess, they are devouring raw materials. And they are also requiring markets to sell their finished goods.
Mm-hmm.
And so, well, America goes by and tries to bribe countries with weapons and all sorts of promises. China goes into countries around the world and says, let's do business. And so China has created this monster where they have to develop business partners, and that's what they do. They went into Afghanistan and says, we don't want to fight wars with you. We want to partner with you in developing your mineral resources. They went into Pakistan and said, you know, we don't want to rent the Taliban from you. What we want to do is build a road together that enables commerce. So the Chinese are becoming the economic superpower of the world. And
they unload a lot of their goods in Iran, by the way. Yao will tell you about, you know, all this cheap radio or this or that. They all break and everything. They're really lousy goods. But she'll tell you that, you know, they've been buying Chinese goods over there forever.
But the fact of the matter is that, you know, the largest factory in the world is in China. And it makes the Apple factory, making iPads and
Facebook. A lot of suicide
phones. Right. Mm-hmm. But... I use a computer every day. My computer was made in China. I use a cell phone every day. My cell phone was made in China. I use an iPad virtually every day. It was made in China. All of these things were made in China. And so China, in terms of technology, is manufacturing of technological products. And if you watch television, you're watching a Chinese product. This phone that I'm talking on, it's China, the monitor I'm looking
at. Oh, yeah, well, they've moved up. I mean, they've moved up, but they've been there for years.
But they're the ultimate influence in the world at Armageddon. But I think that they're going to march in with the Iranians. And I know that, you know, our purpose today was to go through Noah, but these affirmations of what's going to happen, like the program observations, what we want to talk about is history, past, present, and future. And there is future history, and we're actually talking now about future history.
I'm enjoying this. This is a tremendous discussion where we went to. This is keep going.
Yeah,
I'm enjoying your insights there. Really,
is that you mentioned that you thought, and this is my conclusion, that virtually all of the plagues that man endures are either of his own
self-inflicted,
or they're natural events. For example, I am convinced that there is climate change. I do not think climate change is man-made, although I think that we have done a lot of things to negatively influence our planet. You know, for example, the oceans do have much higher carbon content and acidic content that we've created. But the fact is that we are entering a warming period. I think it has nothing to do with man. But the climate is changing. It was 70 some odd degrees here today. It should be in the 40s this time of year. There's something significant that's happening. And I think that when you look at the plagues of the last day and the rise of disease and pestilence, and you look at the sun scorching people with intense heat, and the strike of the asteroid, the strike of the tidal wave for the mountain that falls into the sea, I think those are all natural events, that are perpetrated by natural calamities.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got the man-made calamities of the Magog War and the second phase, which goes nuclear. I think it's a combination of the two. Now, that is not to say that during the last 3.5 years of the tribulation, that Yahweh isn't saying, all right, we... I don't want the entire earth destroyed because, I'm going... My plan was not to create a new earth. My plan is to
repair
the earth. Yeah, to repair the earth. Just like he's repairing the covenant. He's not creating a new covenant. He's not creating a new earth at this point. He wants to repair the earth. And he's going to keep us from completely destroying it. He's made promises to Israel and to Jerusalem. It's going to get dinged and nicked and hurt and bleed and raped, but it's going to survive. And so he wants to at this point thwart this ongoing menacing nature of humankind so that he has a planet to repair. And and so I do think that during that last 3.5 years, it is possible that with humans that have signed on to be with HaSatan, that he is afflicting them.
I want to let me make this point, though.
By the way, we're
calling the oceans more acidic as a non sequitur because an ocean is alkaline to begin with. It's not more acidic. And what ends up happening when it's less alkaline is you get deep ocean water upwelling. That's it.
Yeah.
That's it. And I actually think we're going into a cooling phase. That's based on, and I've done a lot of reading on it. I really believe we're going into a cooling phase. Now, when you start throwing in, a nuclear war, all bets are off. Okay.
If you look at the history of climate change, we are about 150 years into a warming period, and the shortest warming and cooling periods are 300 years. The longest are about 750 years.
Yet the hottest decade was in the 30s, so we know it's not due to carbon dioxide.
I agree that the global warming is not due to man. We came through a 15 or 16 year pause in it. But it doesn't change the fact that we came out of the little ice age, the last cold period, and we're now into a natural warming period. And if you look at the history of the Earth, those periods go from a minimum of 300 years to a minimum of about 700 or to a maximum of 750 years in the frequency. So we are in the midst of a warming period. But
there's a particular doctor that I listened to, and he showed where all the numbers had been diluted. Okay, he was dealing with the coffee drinkers up in Washington State,
mm-hmm.
and talking to the state senators there.
Mm-hmm.
He does probably the best job of putting the kibosh on man-made global warming. I'll shoot that over to you.
We're gaining ice on the poles, not losing ice on the poles. Well, we're
right.
Losing ice on the glaciers. So we're losing ice on the glaciers, gaining ice on the poles. But the biggest issue with the global warming / climate change is that even if man was responsible, let's say that we are entering a warming period, which analysis of the Earth's history would affirm we began a warming period around 1850. And the evidence for the warming and cooling trends having nothing to do with fossil fuels and nothing to do with man is unarguable. It is it's irrefutable. But let's just say that man has contributed some percentage to this current warming period. Let's just use that as a hypothetical. That 20% of the reason that we're slightly warmer than we would have been with just the natural warming and cooling period, it was because of man and carbon-based fuels.
Well, that couldn't be.
If man were to use 100% of his resources and 100% of his ability,
yeah, they could affect
the
by a half 50 degree
years to undo whatever he had done that had caused it, we couldn't make an iota worth of difference.
The problem with that is that first off, 95% of all greenhouse gases are water vapor. So you're going to have to dry up rivers and oceans and mud puddles and swamps and everything else, because that's where it's all coming from. The amount of carbon is so small in the air as compared to all the other particles.
Including actually, a volcano is what creates more carbon in a matter of of a few days than man does.
Man's ever created times 100. Yeah,
well,
I know.
So there's a lot of sources of carbon. Certainly, we have added to the carbon. Whether or not that has had any effect on the temperature is questionable. But there is nothing we can do to avert it, which means that the entire purpose of the climate change negotiations are control.
Regulations.
Well, it's to establish a communal form of worldwide governance that enables individuals to take money from those who are productive, to give money to those who are not productive, to create a group of people who are dependent upon them, and a much smaller group of people who are now deprived of their earnings and therefore are less able to influence them or anyone else, and now are easier to control, with the dependent people being totally easy to control. So the whole purpose is wealth redistribution for the express purpose of control. That is 100% of the mindset and the purpose of these climate...
but you left out enriching the elite who get to run the programs. You know, I mean,
this is what I think a lot of people miss about that. I said the same thing using different words. Money is actually a liability. It's not an asset because of fiat currency. So money itself is not something that the would seek. What they're seeking is control. That's why fascism and communism are exactly the same beast, because ultimately control is the thing that is empowering. It's not money. And so the purpose of creating a dependent class and of disenfranchising those who might otherwise have the ability to prevent you from rising is the purpose of the climate talks. Because they all know it's not a matter of money. It's a matter of control. If you're in control, then you have all the benefits that the that can be.
Now, money's a moot point at that point.
That is correct. So
exactly.
Control is a bigger deal to these folks than is money.
Control is ownership without having
the
liabilities.
That is why fascism and communism are the same beast. And that's why if you're going to look at the future and the New World Order, look at them as the same beast. It's all a matter of control and who's in control. And that's what climate change is all about. Well, guys, we've actually come to the end of our program. We had a lively discussion. We didn't get to the topic we wanted to get to, but, you know, we've got...
Yeah, it doesn't matter. I thought it was a really great show. I was really, really impressed. That turned me around. I thought that the Magog war would be led by the Shias, and I'm wrong. And I'm, I can see that.
Be careful about, I'm reading the same material that you're reading.
This is your guess.
As I evaluate all the things that are happening, that's the conclusion that I have drawn from the evidence.
You're pretty good at that. No.
Well, if they have nuclear weapons, then they can certainly, it balances the scale against so many Sunnis. So
it is not a position that I came to because I wanted to, because the fact that the Shias are outgunned 25-1 and outmanned 5-1 tells you that the Islamic State and Sunni Islam is going to prevail over over Shia Islam.
Yeah.
But as you really think through what's going to happen based upon the world's alliances and the various positions of the various parties. I just don't come to that conclusion. I don't think that Sunni and Shia are going to fight to the death. I think that that it's much more likely the scenario that we discussed today on the program is a much more likely scenario and much more consistent with this story that Yah was telling us about future history.
Two really quick things. I heard you on the Louis Free show.
Yeah.
I wanted to drink whatever he was drinking. I didn't think he was ever going to stop laughing. Is that a recent show?
I did Louis. The last time I did Louis Free was about 10 days ago. It was one of the few times I've ever called. I just called Louis Free uninvited. You know, normally Louis will send me a bunch of emails and we'll schedule a time. And I went on the vacation, and that's when San Bernardino happened, and when Donald Trump made his statement about Islam. And so I knew Louis would want to talk to it. So just as a surprise, I called him one day, right after I got back. So it was about 10 days ago, I guess, was the last time I did one of his shows. He gets so much hate mail.
Really?
Once I do one of his shows, he kind of needs to space them a bit apart. But
well, that means you're doing something right. Would you do me a favor, Kirk? Could you put that link in Unpopular Truth? Because I have not been able to hear right
now. That was Terry screaming.
Maybe Terry can do it.
Well, you know, there are a lot of things that Weldings I would encourage you to do in this is Louis Free answers his emails. Send Louis Free an email. He gets so much flack from people who, because I cut nobody any slack on the Louis Free show, and I know that so many people despise me on the Louis Free show. I said, okay, one of you wizards out there that think that I'm being unkind to Islam by making these statements, why don't you come and debate me? You know, come on, stand up.
Call
and if you want, you want to
send me a link
and pedophiles and mass murderers and slavers, that guys that go and take little girls and gang rape them, then you tell me. Let's pick a time and we'll debate who's right here. You know, so I give them no pause. But if you write Louis Free, if you Google Louis Free, you'll come up with a show and you'll find his contact information. I think it's probably good that he hears from. From people who aren't opposed to the truth.
Yeah, maybe Hugo will call in one day and debate you.
Well, hey, listen, will you send me a link to his email, and I will post that in Unpopular Truth so we can, you know, have a little positive in there.
And so it's clear here, Louis Free and I are good friends. I've met him personally. He is Jewish by race. He is not a rabbinic Jew by religion, by any stretch of the imagination, but we are good friends. I like the man very much.
I always love listening to you on his show, so.
Well, I know he's not, because he's the vegan, maybe not a vegan, but a vegetarian.
Yeah, he's a vegetarian, that is correct. Yeah,
but he thinks that's scriptural, which is sad.
Yeah, I shut him down on that, too, and he now knows that's not scriptural.
One last thing. I don't know whether y'all heard about Congress. They voted for censoring anyone in America. They're trying to pass a law to...
Says anything negative about Islam.
Anything negative about Islam is supposed to go to the Senate soon.
Well, it's quoting their Congress negative.
That's what the article, I think, said, but I'll double-check.
Yeah, double-check. Could you send that to me if in fact they did that? That is, it's going to happen. It is one of the reasons why I stopped doing the show. I knew it was going to happen. And I stopped doing the show because of the fact that I don't want to be silenced for saying something about Islam, because I've said more than enough about Islam.
Yeah.
I want to continue to do what we did on observations.
Right.
You know, there's three reasons we do what we do on observations. One is we enjoy one another's company as brothers in the covenant, and so we just enjoy talking with one another. Number two, we enjoy learning, because every time we go through this material, you know, here we're talking about Yahweh's prophetic portrayal of history. Every time we go through the material, we learn something new, and it's exciting to learn. And number three, this is the best deal in the universe, and we're motivated.
Sure.
Right. And those are the only three reasons we do it, and I'd much rather do that than be attacked for telling people the truth about Islam. Because really, I don't give a rat's patootie anymore about it. I really don't care.
You've already done everything you can there.
I don't know what else you can add to it.
And I don't care if they're destroyed by Islam. I don't care if they're murdered by Islam. I don't care if they're raped by Islam. We've done our job. And if they're just too stupid, too apathetic, too immoral to care, it's their own damn fault.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't care anymore. I mean, I really have lost the ability to care.
Our only job is to leave people with no excuse.
That is
we provide all the evidence out there in the world. It's up to them to take it and read it and do it what they want with it. But we leave them with no excuse.
It totally is. Yeah.
But it'll be only a matter of time before the site is shut down and there'll be no more discussion. It's only a matter of time.
Yeah, that's right. And they have to do that. I mean, because, you know, that's what they do is squelch truth.
And they want this war. They want the war with the Islamic State. And there's only one way to defeat Islamic terrorism, and that's to confront Islam with the truth. So what they're going to do is outlaw any discussion regarding the truth about Islam. That's what they're doing, because they want the war.
Sickening.
Yeah, and by the way, I'm not saying that because of some opinion. They started this war deliberately.
Oh, yeah.
They want this war.
World War One was almost like drawing parallels to this. World War Two, as a result of World War One, is unbelievable sickness.
Yeah.
What we've done.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, to be a patriot, you have to be immoral and ignorant.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's just the bottom line. All right, fellas.
Good night.
We'll
listen to
God as we do our next recording. Happy Shabbat. That was fun tonight.
Yes, it was.
I had a great time.
Enjoyed it.
I did too, and thanks for going over the Yovel like that.
I was thinking about why we're doing observations and why the group came to together. It's the bottom line is, it's fun to get together.
It sure is.
Yeah.
It's fun to talk about this stuff. All right, guys. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Thank you.